Yeah, well, Joel, we're walking through a big stand of mangroves just on the southern side of the Parramatta River, about 20 k's from the CBD. And so, like a lot of mangroves in urban areas, they've been disturbed through the construction of seawalls and pathways and roads and things like that. And here at Sydney Olympic Park, with the construction of some pathways, it basically restricted the flow of tides in and out of these wetlands. And because it restricted the tides, we tended to get large stands of stagnant water, and it created ideal conditions for mosquitoes. So what we're walking up to now is one of the special channels that's been constructed through the mangroves, and the idea here is to return some tidal flushing to the system. Now that we've constructed these channels, it basically pulls the plug on these mosquito habitats. And so the advantages have been so numerous. First and foremost, the mangroves are healthier. We're getting a return of fish and things to the system. But most importantly of all, from the mosquito perspective, is that the populations have reduced so much that we don't actually need to do any active mosquito control in this area. And so it's a great example where you can rehabilitate a degraded area of wetland and actually reduce the productivity of mosquitoes.
The smell of summer, isn't it? That somewhat acrid smoke of a sand-textured, army green mosquito coil. Or if you're lucky, the almost pleasant, lemony aroma of a citronella candle. Usually, we do all that we can to avoid mosquitoes. But not Cameron Webb. He actively tracks them down. Hi, I'm Joel Werner, and this is Off Track, RN's show about nature, the environment and the outdoors. And today, we're joining Cameron on the hunt for mosquitoes. Cameron's a medical entomologist, and the decisions he makes, like those he helped make at Sydney Olympic Park, aren't just good ideas, they're good ideas backed by hard science.
Together with the Sydney Olympic Park Authority, we sort of sat down and worked out a way in which we could sort of bring these tides back into the wetlands, because we identified that that was the main problem that was contributing to the production of mosquitoes. And we knew that because we were doing some good quantitative sampling of mosquito productivity. If you're just to walk through the mangroves, maybe you would think it all looked pretty much the same, but when we look at the data for mosquito populations, we know that there are areas with key hotspots. These are the areas we need to target. You've got to sort of be informed by good quantitative data. And so what we were able to compare was basically the abundance of the immature stages of the key pest species from the degraded area of mangroves and compare it to other areas, to other reference sites. And when we compare them, it was sort of quite dramatic. We're getting sort of 10 to 20, maybe on occasions even 100-fold the abundance of mosquitoes in some of these degraded areas. And that's something that I see throughout the coast where I'm working, is that even though mosquitoes are a natural part of our coastal wetlands, in some senses the really unusually large mosquito populations are a symptom of degraded wetlands.
So Cameron, for most Australians, it's a case of avoiding the mosquitoes. It's almost a ritual that we engage in, but you're quite the opposite. You actually actively hunt out mosquitoes.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that I'm actively hunting out mosquitoes. I mean, most of the people that I work for and in some of my projects, the objective is to have their wetlands not producing mosquitoes, so ideally I wouldn't be finding them. But certainly during the summer I spend most of my time trying to catch them, and that includes both the adults that are flying around causing nuisance biting or spreading disease. But most importantly of all, it's also collecting the immature stages. They're the stages that live in the water, and that's probably the best gauge we have of the productivity of a wetland in terms of whether it's contributing to the local mosquito problem.
So how do you go about catching a mosquito?
We use some pretty basic equipment, really. I mean, if we're looking for the immature stages, it's a case of getting our feet muddy and getting out into the wetlands, and we need to survey it pretty much using some pretty primitive equipment, which is not dissimilar to a soup ladle, really. Getting out there and sampling the larvae that we find in the wetlands, taking them back to the laboratory and identifying them, counting them, taking a note of their developmental stage. And when we use that data together with some of the physical environmental data, like the vegetation, for instance, the vegetation types, combine that with some climatic information, things like temperature, rainfall and tides, we can develop these models that both identify these hot spots of the habitats where mosquitoes are breeding, but also identify the environmental drivers of mosquito productivity, which is really important as well. We want to be able to predict when mosquito populations are going to increase.
So you take a sample and then you build a model and you'll be able to say, okay, this is a similar location somewhere else and we reckon there's going to be a lot of mosquitoes there. Is that the basic gist of it?
Yeah, it definitely is. We want to know, I guess in complicated scientific terms, we want to look at the spatial distribution of the hotspots and the temporal environmental drivers of abundance. So basically, where are the mosquitoes breeding and what causes them to increase?
Now, I remember from first year biology, we had quadrant samplers, I think they were called, a sort of metre squared bit of wood that you'd throw down in an area like this. I actually did some work in a mangrove once, and you'd use that quadrant to highlight a sample that you'd then assume was representative of the area around it. Is this the same sort of technique you use when you go out to collect mosquitoes?
Yeah, it changed a little bit. You're right, Joel, in that that's the sort of standard way you might go about randomised sampling of a wetland. But we're probably a little bit different because if we chose our sites randomly, we'd spend a lot of time and effort where mosquitoes weren't breeding. So mosquitoes don't breed randomly across the environment. They're very specific. And by that I mean they're breeding in areas where there's depressions that hold water for at least a week after rain or high tides. And so we tend to be more targeted. We still take a relatively sort of randomised approach amongst those known mosquito breeding hotspots, if you like. But we need to be fairly specific when we're sampling because we need to get that data to be able to compare between these different sites and different sort of microhabitats, if you like.
So Cameron, we're off the boardwalk and now we're out in the open. Set the scene for us.
Yeah, so we've stepped out from the shade and the cover of the mangroves into the open salt marsh environment. And this is kind of one of my favourite wetland areas to work in. I really like the salt marsh. And the reason the plants here are very special is that they can tolerate high levels of salinity. So they love to grow in these areas where it's flooded by the high tides during the summer. So it's very salty, keeps away some of the other weeds and things that you might find on land. There's only a few plants here, but they're really sort of special. We've got these sort of small kind of plants called Suede australis. It sort of feels a little bit like suede when you feel the leaves. It's really interesting. But there's this beautiful kind of green, reddish, purplish, succulent plant called Sarcocornia quinquiflora. And it's the true sort of salt marsh plant. And it actually looks quite beautiful. And you can sort of see these shades of different colours over the course of the season. I really love it. And then you've got these really sort of small, leafy, dark green plants. This is Wilsonia backhousei. And incredibly rare plant that's only found in a few places in Sydney, and we're just sort of standing alongside one stand of that here. And even though it isn't strongly linked to mosquito habitat, it's one of the great plants that I love to look at when I'm sort of out here wandering around the salt marsh.
As a Sydney sider, this is a very familiar setting as well. This salt marsh environment, it's up and down the east coast of Australia. Is it ubiquitous to this part of the world?
It definitely is. Along the coast of New South Wales, up into southeast Queensland in particular, salt marsh are very widely distributed along the coast. The suite of plants that you might find on the salt marsh changes from location to location, but generally speaking, it's right along the coast. The biggest problem, though, is it's one of our most threatened environments in Australia. And you know, historically, we used to think of them as swamps and stinky, mosquito-ridden places, and we didn't really acknowledge how important they were, both as wildlife habitat to our coastal sort of ecosystems. They've been filled in for dumps, they've been built over the top of for roads and railways, and they've even been reclaimed for housing developments and things like that. And one of the real problems we have with these environments is that they're susceptible to sea level rise. As the sea level goes up, the habitats are flooded more frequently. It allows the intrusion of mangroves into these environments. And one of the problems that we get, as well as overgrowing the salt marsh, once you have mangroves growing in the middle of these salt marsh pools, they become less suitable for some of our wading birds because the birds like to sit out in the middle of the ponds. They like to be able to look around to see if there's any predators sneaking up on them. And as soon as you start to get mangroves growing in the middle of them, the birds don't like them so much, and so they'll move elsewhere. And so it's one of these habitats which is classified as an endangered ecological community, and it really is going to take a lot of effort to conserve this environment in the coast in the years to come.
I guess another problem with these type of locations is that they typically occur right on the coastline, and as we can see in the distance, there's apartment blocks in both directions. Humans love to live on the coast, and this is what a lot of your work does, is try to identify where we're encroaching on what would be typically mosquito habitat.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm particularly interested in urban design, and I guess you could call it mosquito-aware urban design. And that's about acknowledging that mosquitoes are a natural part of our Australian wetland environment. And historically, we lived a fair way away from these wetlands, but now we're living on their back door, if you like. A lot of my work, what it does, it informs planning decisions by local councils to say, look, if you're going to redevelop this area which is quite close to the wetland, notwithstanding the possibility you'll impact the wetland itself, you have to understand that people coming to live here are going to be impacted by mosquitoes. And that's not just the nuisance biting, but it's also the potential transmission of disease-causing pathogens like Ross River virus and Burma forest virus. So while we're never really going to stop coastal development, we need to acknowledge that living near these wetlands brings with it a human health risk as well.
So take us through some of the specific examples of the work you've done managing these types of areas.
I've done some work both around the Hunter region, around Newcastle, but also around the Byron Bay region as well. And I guess that's a good example of where you can put all of these bits of research to practice to help inform the local authorities on planning decisions. If you take a council area like Byron Shire Council, they've got a wide range of potential mosquito habitats, estuarine wetlands, freshwater wetlands, and even sort of backyard habitats. Identifying those areas that are hotspots for mosquito breeding, identifying the environmental triggers for increasing mosquito problems, the local council then can develop risk maps for its area. So that means that if you want to redevelop an old rural property, for instance, for a new residential development, you can go to council and say, well, am I in one of these high-risk zones for mosquito productivity? And just because you live near a salt marsh or a coastal swamp forest doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be predisposed to a big mosquito impact, but in some situations you certainly will. If mosquito populations are more driven by tides, a regular event during the summer, you're more likely to be impacted. And so then the developer themselves, in collaboration with the council, can make planning decisions about the building design, the layout of the development, that you're not going to eliminate all mosquito impacts, but at least you might be able to assist in reducing some of those impacts.
And the feedback from these projects so far has been successful? This approach is working?
Yeah, I think the most important element of this is that it's a mechanism for the local authorities to inform the community that there is a mosquito problem here and there's a mosquito risk associated with these different areas within the council. Sometimes you've got a lot of people moving out of the city, whether it be Brisbane or Sydney, up into these sort of coastal areas for a bit of a sea change. And they've often never experienced big mosquito populations before, and they certainly might not be aware of the risks of some of our mosquito-borne diseases, which are annually abundant along the coast. And I think that getting that message across to the individual as well about taking personal measures to avoid mosquito bites is really crucial in reducing the incidence of disease.
And I guess the important idea that it's not the mosquitoes coming to bite the sea changes, it's the sea changes invading what is traditionally mosquito habitat.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that both the sea changes, but also the local residents themselves and tourists coming into the new area, they're a prime blood meal for all the mosquitoes. So they're more than welcoming to the new humans coming into town. But certainly we want to try to reduce the incidence of disease in these coastal areas. And it's an annual battle that we have about primarily trying to inform the community about how to avoid mosquito bites and avoid these mosquito-borne diseases.
You're listening to Off Track on RN. I'm Joel Werner, and today we're tracking down mosquitoes with medical entomologist Dr. Cameron Webb.
So Cameron, I just swatted a potential lab rat for you. Killed a mosquito that was biting my arm. Occupational health and safety, how does it go for you working with mosquitoes all day?
Yeah, look, I'd love to say that I'm always wearing repellent, but I don't want to contaminate a lot of our equipment, so I tend not to. I guess as well as a bit of tolerance to the occasional mosquito bite, I tend to opt for the sort of long sleeve shirt and long pants rather than repellents all the time, even though they're very effective. But yes, together with sunburn, one of the occupational health and safety issues I have to deal with most days of the summer.
Now, you should just knock that one off your head. There's one just landed on your face. There's obviously a lot of mosquitoes around here. We've just come up to some ponds. This is where you work.
Yeah, that's right. And so I guess what we're sort of faced ahead of us, Joel, here is a series of ponds that are on the edge of the mangroves into the salt marsh. And these are areas where the tides have come up about a week or so ago. They've flooded these ponds, and all the mosquito eggs that would have otherwise been lying dormant in the soil and at the base of the salt marsh vegetation have hatched. And most of those adults could have emerged, and they're the ones that are chasing us at the moment. But let's go and have a look and see if we can find anything, because I'd love to show you some of the mosquito larvae. So we've come up to the site here, and I guess that this is a great illustration of what I was talking about in terms of mosquitoes aren't randomly spread throughout the salt marsh. They're only going to be in these pools, and it's in these pools that we want to look at. So I'm just going to use my dipper. It holds about 300 mils of water, and it looks a little bit like a modified soup ladle. But let's just take a bit of a dip here and see if we can find any mosquito larvae. And so what we're looking for now is we're just looking into the dipper here. There's a couple of hundred mils of water here. And at the moment, anyway, there's not much movement of anything live in the sample here at the moment. But let's take another dip and we'll just see if we can find something.
So when you're looking in the ladle, you're looking for some sort of movement then?
Yeah, we're looking for the immature stage of the mosquito. So people would commonly refer to them as wrigglers. And it's something that everybody's probably seen in their bird bath or in a swimming pool if they haven't cleaned it out over the course of the winter. It's these immature stages that give us a good indication of the productivity of the wetland. So we're looking at their numbers and also the different species that we might find. So there might be anything up to three or four different species that we'd find in these type of habitats. So we can see a few things moving around in here. We can see these large worm-like critters in here. Now, they're some sort of beetle larvae or something like that. So they're not mosquitoes, but so you don't want to get too alarmed at those. But let's have a look for some more mosquito larvae.
Okay, third time's the charm.
Yeah, so we're looking in here, this dipper now. We can see a couple of what we've been after, a couple of mosquito wrigglers here. Now, they're about 2 or 3 millimetres in length, and these are the immature stages of the salt marsh mosquito, Aedes vigilax, and it's the major pest and vector of disease that we find in coastal wetlands. It's up and down the coast of New South Wales and Queensland, also in WA. Now, the really unique thing about these mosquito larvae is obviously they're tolerant of really salt water. You can see them sort of quite happily wriggling around in the dipper here. But they breathe air through a siphon that attaches to their sort of water-air interface. And during summer, when it's quite hot, it probably only takes a week from them to hatch out from their eggs until they emerge as adults. So these big fat wrigglers we're looking at the moment, they'll probably emerge as adults in the next couple of days. So if we come back, they'll be out of the water and chasing us around on the wing.
So your job is just to obviously identify where the wrigglers can be found. Do you then sample them in terms of numbers? Is there some count that you do?
Yeah, it certainly is. So as most biologists do, we just sort of count up the numbers that we're collecting and the different species we collect. And when we compare that over time, but also compare that to different sites in the salt marsh, we can identify areas that are more likely to be more productive for mosquitoes than others. And what that does is that both informs the management of the wetland itself, because it might identify areas that might be candidates for habitat modification to reduce the productivity of mosquitoes. Or maybe if we're using a mosquito control agent, we can be effective in the way that we're using that by targeting this specifically, these hotspots, if you like, of mosquito productivity.
Sampling wrigglers is relatively easy. You put your sampler into the pond, you pull it out, and occasionally you'll get a sampler full of wriggling mosquito larvae. Catching adults, how do you go about that?
Yeah, it's a bit more difficult. It's not particularly hard, but it's a bit more difficult. One of the things we have to keep in mind when we're going to collect the adult mosquitoes is that mosquitoes fly, and different species fly different distances away from their breeding habitat. You've got some mosquitoes might only fly 100 metres or so, but others might fly 5, 6, 7 kilometres from their breeding habitat. So one of the important things is when we're assessing the mosquito risk at an existing wetland or perhaps a constructed wetland, is to identify the mosquito species that not only are coming out of the wetland, but the ones that are causing the nuisance biting around the wetland. So if you've just built a new wetland or you're currently improving a degraded wetland and the community is saying to you, hey, I'm getting bitten to death by mosquitoes when I'm around here, sometimes it's not actually the mosquitoes coming out of the wetlands, it might be mosquitoes coming out of people's backyards that live nearby or out of another habitat. And so for that reason, we want to get a sample of the adult mosquitoes that are around a wetland. We do that with carbon dioxide beta traps. And so what we might do is we might wander along this path and hang it up in some of the trees up ahead of us.
Carbon dioxide as a bait. Have mosquitoes evolved an attraction to carbon dioxide because usually it means big fleshy mammal that they can then eat off?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. I mean, carbon dioxide is one of the major cues that female mosquitoes hone in on, if you like, when they're looking for a blood meal. So it's only the female mosquitoes that bite, and she needs that protein hit in the blood meal to develop her eggs. And so carbon dioxide is a pretty common denominator, if you like, between people, kangaroos, cows, birds, and the mosquitoes will hone in on that as, if you like, a sort of a long-distance attractant. So when they can sense the carbon dioxide coming off our trap, the poor mosquito thinks that she's on her way to a nice, juicy blood meal.
So take us through the ins and outs of the trap. How does it actually work?
So we use dry ice typically. As you know, dry ice is basically frozen carbon dioxide. We just basically fill up our little black billy can with dry ice, and we're going to get the traps out typically just a couple of hours before dusk. That's when mosquitoes are most active, and we want to get it into locations where mosquitoes are going to be seeking refuge or seeking a blood meal, and that's often in sort of shaded, well vegetated areas. So at the moment we're wandering through a stand of casuarinas just on the edge of the salt marsh, and mosquitoes will like that. It's shaded, it's protected from the wind and the sun. Yeah, this is an ideal place to hang our trap.
So let's put the trap in the tree. How long do you usually leave it there for until you can be confident that you'll get some mosquitoes in?
Usually only overnight. Mostly limited by how long the carbon dioxide will last. But once a night, as long as the environmental conditions aren't too tricky, like if it's pouring with rain or blowing a gale, it's not great nights to collect mosquitoes. But generally speaking, if we're in a nice shaded area, close to a wetland, we'll be pretty confident we'll catch quite a few species of mosquitoes and quite a few numbers on occasion.
Well, that was my next question. How many mosquitoes would you likely to get in a trap overnight?
Yeah, look, it can vary everywhere from a couple right up to sort of over 20,000. So again, it's incredibly variable and will depend on not just the environmental conditions but the type of habitats that are nearby. The salt marsh mosquito that we collected as the immature stage earlier, they're often found in really high numbers. So when we're trapping on the coast and we get big numbers, like so 10,000 a trap or so, that's a lot of mosquitoes, and normally I can hear that trap buzzing as it's full of mosquitoes long before I actually collect it.
All right, well, let's leave this one here and head off.
Yep.
Once you've got a trap full of mosquitoes, you take them back to the lab. What happens then, Cam?
Yeah, it's hard to count mosquitoes when they're flying around, so we want to be able to knock them down. And we do that just by placing the trap into the freezer. Just a couple of minutes in the freezer is enough to sort of immobilise the mosquitoes. Then, the same way as you would do with any insect or animal, we use taxonomic keys to identify the different species, and so that might be their colour or the patterning of the scales on their wings or their size and a whole range of different characteristics. But we sort them into species. We then obviously count them according to our trap sites. Sometimes we'll test them for the presence of virus. Or sometimes we might even, if they've got a little bit of blood in them, we can even take that blood out, and using molecular techniques we can identify what animals they've been feeding on. And all of that information goes together to help understand what the risk of mosquito-borne disease might be in a local area, and that sort of feeds back into the way we can manage the wetland and mosquito populations.
Well, it's body on the line research. I'm getting eaten alive out of here. Thanks very much for bringing me out today. It's been great.
Thanks, Joel. No problem.
Dr. Cameron Webb, medical entomologist at the University of Sydney and Westmead Hospital. If Cameron's voice sounds familiar, it might be because you've heard him on Off Track before. Last year, I visited Cameron in his lab at Westmead Hospital. To listen to that interview again, now that you've heard him in the field, follow the link on the Off Track website. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational and search for Off Track. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Off Track podcast via your iTunes library, so you can get off track on your own time. Now, if you're on Twitter, I highly recommend following Cameron. He provides a fascinating behind-the-scenes insight into the world of medical entomology. You can find him at MozzieBytes. And while you're there, look me up too. I'm at Joel Werner. I often feature work conducted in botanical gardens on Off-Track. Well, this week on Ockham's Razor, David Mabberley, the new executive director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney, talks about the role of botanic gardens in modern society. Tune in Sunday morning at 7:45. But that's all there is for this week. Until next time, bye for now.
G'day, Mike and Jesse here with a brand new podcast for you.
It's called Long Story Short, real life Australian stories.
I don't know anyone in town, and the problem is they don't know me.
Meet remarkable characters.
He said, yes, of course I murdered him. I murdered him and cut him up and buried him in the sale yards. Yeah, I bumped him.
They'll share their experiences.
We're not going anywhere in this country. We're here permanently. This is a good fight.
You can download or stream Long Story Short with me, Mike.
And me, Jesse, from the RN website.